Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios.
It's Wednesday, August 12th.
So obviously everyone's talking about California Senator Kamala Harris, now Joe Biden's running mate in the presidential election, and we will too, and we'll open up the phones for your thoughts in a little bit. I want to start with two clips, the first one about a minute long, of Senator Harris. One of the big questions about her during her run for president in the primaries was about her record on criminal justice reform as the San Francisco DA and then as California's Attorney General. Here's 1 minute of how Senator Harris describes her record and her approach to being a prosecutor after she was challenged on it in a CNN town hall in January of last year.
I've been consistent my whole career. My career has been based on an understanding, one, that as a prosecutor, my duty was to seek and make sure that the most vulnerable and voiceless among us are protected. And that is why I have personally prosecuted violent crime that includes rape, child molestation, and homicide. And I have also worked my entire career to reform the criminal justice system, understanding to your point that it is deeply flawed and in need of repair, which is why, as Attorney General, for example, I led the Department of Justice, which is the largest state Department of Justice in any state in California, and implemented the first of its kind in the nation implicit bias and procedural justice training for police officers. It is why I created the first in the nation for any Department of Justice an open data initiative that we named Open Justice for the first time, making transparent and showing the public statistics around deaths in custody, arrest rates by race, and making that information available to the public.
Kamala Harris from a CNN town hall last year when she was in the Democratic primary race for president. Here's one more of her for now. This is Senator Harris kind of in prosecutor mode, the witness, if you will, or maybe the equivalent of the defendant is more like it, is Brett Kavanaugh at his Supreme Court confirmation hearing in 2018. Harris is trying to establish whether Kavanaugh would have a conflict of interest in ruling on issues related to the Mueller investigation by having discussed the case with people from Trump's private law firm if Kavanaugh did that. And maybe as we listen to this clip, we might imagine Harris debating Mike Pence this coming October.
Have you discussed Mueller or his investigation with anyone at Cassowitz, Benson & Torres, the law firm founded by Mark Cassowitz, President Trump's personal lawyer? Be sure about your answer, sir.
So you heard the beginning of what was a lot of squirming by Kavanaugh as he was trying not to give a direct answer to a direct question. Senator Kamala Harris and now Justice Brett Kavanaugh from his confirmation hearing in 2018. With us now, WNYC legal editor, as well as All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd, and Axios reporter, Jonathan Swan. Remember, Swan had maybe the most detailed and specific interview ever with President Trump about 10 days ago. We'll play some relevant excerpts of that. So, Jamie, thanks for coming on, and Jonathan, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Let me first get your top line takes on this pick. Why Kamala Harris out of the various candidates on Biden's shortlist, and what's the significance of this moment, Jamie?
Well, I think it demonstrates that we no longer in political campaigns think in terms of which state I need to select from to win, that old sort of geographic approach to winning. And we are now thinking in terms of much more socio-political matters. And in this moment of pandemic and protest, Kamala Harris made sense. You know, it's a historic moment. It's a historic pick that moves us forward in the direction in which we need to go as a country and a society. And you know, the Biden campaign gets credit for making a smart choice, but Kamala Harris also earned this spot. We need to recognize that, you know, she's been out there marching with the protesters to demand justice for George Floyd and reform of the system, more so than any of the other people who were on the short list. She was one of the senators who led the anti-lynching bill push in the Senate. So she's standing on the right side of history at this moment. And so the Biden campaign recognizes that in choosing her. And I think we should also, Brian, acknowledge, you know, as we approach the 100th anniversary of suffrage next week, the women who came before her on this journey, and not just the other women who ran this time with her, such as Elizabeth Warren and our own Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, but the trailblazers who came before her, like, of course, Hillary Clinton, but also the black women who came before her, like Shirley Chisholm, the first black candidate for a major party presidential nomination, the first woman to run for the Democratic Party nomination, first black woman to run for it. And then, you know, of course, we could go all the way back to Victoria Woodhull. But, you know, I mentioned Shirley Chisholm because when Kamala was just a girl, you know, Shirley Chisholm was running for president. That had to have, you know, alighted her imagination as a girl. I know it did so for mine. And now Kamala is poised to walk through the doors of the White House, not as first lady, but as vice president, and quite possibly someday as president of the United States.
Yeah, and good point about building on the work of others who came before her. Next week is the 100th anniversary week of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote in this country. And people remember Elizabeth Cady Stanton and some of the other white suffragists. We're going to have an author on the anniversary week who talks about some of the forgotten black women suffragists who fought for that right but were not as remembered in history. Jonathan, same question. Why Kamala Harris out of the various candidates on Biden's shortlist, and what's the significance of this moment?
Well, I think Jamie spoke very eloquently to the significance of the moment. As for the calculations in the Biden camp, this was pragmatism overriding everything else. She is someone who has been battle-tested. They wanted someone. They know this is going to be the roughest, ugliest campaign, probably even uglier than 2016. And they need someone who can handle herself in that environment, who has shown a capacity to perform on the debate stage. There's going to be only one debate between her and Mike Pence, and that's going to have a significant amount of importance, particularly as people are going to be looking at her as the heir apparent, and Biden has set this election up as a transitional election that he will be effectively at some point handing over the keys. He sort of intimated that he may be a one-term president, so people will be looking at her. You know, you always consider whether the vice president is capable of serving as president, but I think that question has added intensity in this election, given that Joe Biden is the oldest nominee that we've seen in American history for a major party. So that's important there. Also, politically, the Trump campaign, she was probably of the short list, based on my conversations with President Trump's advisors over the last few weeks, she was their least preferred pick. They are trying, you know, they've thrown around a number of different attack lines against Joe Biden, mostly unsuccessful because they haven't driven up his negatives in polling the way they would hope. But the one that they've settled on, the frame that they've settled on, is this idea that Biden is this mentally incapacitated puppet or vessel for the far left. The idea that when you elect Joe Biden, you're not really electing this moderate, genial figure that you've known for decades. You're actually electing this man who will be entirely controlled by the far left. And so they wanted, to the extent that the VP pick mattered, they would have preferred that the Biden team pick somebody who would have been easier to fit into that frame, to say, you know, they were already, for example, leaping on Congresswoman Karen Bass's past statements about Fidel Castro. They were calling her Communist Karen. They would have preferred that they pick that he picked Karen Bass so that they could say, see here, we told you, you know, he is this radical leftist. Kamala Harris doesn't really give them that opportunity. She has a fairly pragmatic history. To the extent that she's been criticized, it's largely for being too tough on law and order during her tenure as Attorney General in California. So it doesn't really lend itself to the idea that she's this wild-eyed communist radical Antifa sympathizer. It doesn't really fit into that frame.
Jamie, I want to follow up on what Jonathan just brought up with respect to Senator Harris's record on crime and criminal justice reform, and especially for you as a lawyer and our legal editor. Looking back over the press clips from the last year, it's easy to find a range of opinion, even just in progressive circles. So, for example, in USA Today, a piece by public defender Nikki Solis called "I Worked with Kamala Harris, She Was the Most Progressive DA in California," versus one from Connor Friedersdorf in The Atlantic last year called "When Kamala Harris Was a Top Cop, Can the Candidate Be Trusted to Hold Government Officials Accountable and Oversee a Progressive Criminal Justice System? Her Past Says No." How do you begin to weave this together and into an understanding of her record in this area?
Well, I think you look at the facts, and I think rather than opinion about sentiment and whether or not one likes Kamala Harris, and I should say I go back a long way with Kamala Harris. We're not besties, but we are Bay Area black women who practice law in the Bay Area, and that's a pretty small club. And Tony Harris, her brother-in-law, and I actually practiced law together at the same law firm when we first started out. So
I did not know that.
Yes, and we've kept up over the years. So I know Kamala's record quite well. I was a public defender when she was a district attorney, both when we were first starting out. But of course, I then watched her career very closely, and I know her record quite well. And when she started out as a prosecutor, she was at the Alameda County DA's office, which is one of the most progressive in the country to start with. You know, being a district attorney in and of itself is not a progressive thing, but this is the 90s. So, you know, if you think you might want to get into politics, you don't become a public defender like I did in those days. You might do that now, but you become a prosecutor. If you think you want to help the black and brown community, you become a prosecutor. That's what she did in the most progressive office in the Bay Area. She then later goes to the San Francisco DA's office, which was then run by a very progressive man named Terrence Hallinan. She didn't like the way he ran the office, so she runs against her old boss in 2003. It's a very bitter election, one which she, by the way, in which she chooses to set up her campaign headquarters in Bayview Hunters Point, which is one of the most isolated to this day, but certainly then, isolated and neglected parts of San Francisco. It's a black neighborhood in San Francisco. San Francisco, I will say publicly on this station, was then and remains a very segregated city. And Kamala campaigned on a promise to not seek the death penalty, to only prosecute three strikes cases in very violent felonies. She claimed that Terrence Hallinan was neglecting black and brown communities that were plagued by violence, especially gun violence, places like Bayview and the Tenderloin. And she claimed that victims of rape and domestic violence, mostly black and brown women, were being neglected. So this was a progressive prosecution agenda. And then, and quote, she said, quote, "It's not progressive to be soft on crime," with an eye to the black community. And looking back with hindsight, it's easy to criticize, but she was hearing from these communities and these women. And then when she was elected, Brian, she made good on those promises. She did not seek the death penalty. And even on one case where a very respected police officer was tragically killed, she did not prosecute marijuana cases or reduce them to misdemeanors. And this progressive approach didn't end with her campaign promises. She actually set up a special court to divert young offenders and try and get them out of the system. I could go on, but some of her reforms are still in place. And you're hearing this, by the way, Brian, from someone, as you know, whose life work has been dedicated to the cause of equality and justice from the perspective of the criminal defense bar.
Yes.
So I know there's been criticism of her, but I think it's generally unfair, though I am grappled with, you know, whether to defend a former prosecutor who's going to run for president. I've assessed her record. I've talked with people. Nikki Solis, I read her. I worked with Nikki Solis, by the way. Mm-hmm. I read her op-ed, and I think she's spot on. If we're clear-eyed about it and we look at the record of Kamala Harris, she's a perfect balance for Joe Biden, who is going to have to defend his record on that crime bill that we've heard so much about. So right, that's now, my answer to the question. Look at the facts. Look at the facts of her record.
Seth in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. You're on WNYC. Hello, Seth. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for this segment. So when you asked how I felt about it and then gave two polar opposites that hit the nail on the head, I am deeply moved by, almost to tears in this moment that the top of our presidential ticket has a black woman. And then I am also deeply disappointed based on some of the things that, you know, the Atlantic article points out. I have to do much more investigation, but my gut tells me that this ticket is appealing for moderates, because my sense is, from my Facebook feed and from everything I read, people just want to erase 2020, pretend it never happened, let's go back somewhere, and somewhere back there doesn't exist anymore. And I think that climate change and redistributing police resources to communities are essential.
Seth, thank you very much. I'm going to leave it there. Paula in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paula.
Brian, good morning. Actually, it's Paula Whitney. I'm transgender.
Okay. Hi.
I'm a dark-skinned former Manhattan prosecutor under Robert Morgenthau. I have first an observation and then a question. My observation is that, with the exception of Val Demings and Stacey Abrams, all of Biden's other potential running mates are all very light-skinned women, such as Keisha Lance Bottoms, Susan Rice, and Tammy Duckworth. My question is, did Biden pick from this particular pool in order to sway white voters?
Paula Whitney, thank you very much. Jonathan Swan, I will throw that question to you.
Oh, that's a question that I can't possibly answer. I don't have any insight into how he thought about that, or even whether he thought about that. So I completely punt.
But I don't. I'll take it. As a light-skinned black woman who has often been told I look like Kamala Harris, which is an extraordinary compliment. I don't know if the caller said that she is African American. One of the last two callers did say
she
that,
said
that dark she was African American.
Yeah, she called herself dark skinned.
Okay. So colorism is an extraordinary problem in our society. I agree with Jonathan that we cannot know how much that how much the campaign thought about, or Biden himself thought about the race. We know they thought about race because they said they were going to take a black woman, but the actual skin tone of the candidate. But I think we have to be honest in this country about how much color plays a role in the relative success of black people. And I say this as a light-skinned black woman who understands that color, being a light-skinned person, benefits a light-skinned black woman. And if you're a darker-skinned black woman, that is a struggle and a burden. And we can talk about black men in a different, it's a different rubric. And so I think it's a very profound question that the caller asked. But I do think that for any voters who may want to question Kamala and her, and I've heard this conversation had within the black community about her black bona fides. I've had the question about my own black bona fides. There are cold, hard facts about Kamala's deep roots in the African-American community. She was born in Oakland, California. She grew up going to a Black Baptist church, and she also went to a Hindu temple because her parents wanted her to have that interfaith background. She went to an HBCU, Howard University. She chose to go to a historically Black college. Mm-hmm. And then, as we all now know, famously, she began kindergarten in her second year and in that desegregation busing program, which she so famously chided Joe Biden about on the stage. And then finally, Brian, I will mention that she and her sister were taunted when they visited her father. Her parents divorced, and they visited her father at Palo Alto because he taught at Stanford, and the other children would not play with them because they were Black. So she is light-skinned, yes, and Maya is also light-skinned, but they suffered that extraordinarily painful Black experience of being discriminated against. So even with the colorism, we share this as Black people, this lived experience of discrimination. So I think she feels it deeply, and to the extent I know her through her brother-in-law, it is a shared experience in that family of being African-American in America.
Jonathan Swan, as you know, we originally invited you on today before the running mate news broke to talk about your Trump interview last week and the ramifications. Congratulations on asking, from my point of view, follow-up questions probably better than anyone I've ever heard with Trump, who always tries to change the subject. This will go down as one of the unforgettable things that we're about to replay that he's ever said as you press him on the COVID death toll in the United States on his watch, not just the number of cases.
I think it's under control. I'll tell you what.
How? 1,000 Americans are dying a day.
They are dying. That's true. And it is what it is. But that doesn't mean we aren't doing everything we can. It's under control as much as you can control it.
How do you see that answer politically, 10 days or whatever it is later, and what it revealed about his relationship to the pandemic?
Well, it doesn't matter what poll you look at, whether it's a public poll, whether it's doing reporting on private polling. The American public appears to have made up their mind on their assessment of President Trump's handling of the coronavirus, and it is not a positive verdict. The American public do not approve of the way that he's handled this virus. So the realists inside President Trump's camp understand that the extent to which the election is a referendum on his handling of the coronavirus is the extent to which he's unlikely to be reelected. What they want to do is change the conversation. And part of the reason they're so aggressively publicizing and discussing the possibility of a vaccine is because what they're trying to create is a situation where in October, the public conversation has moved beyond who of these two men is most fit to handle the worst public health crisis in a century onto a conversation about, well, okay, it looks likely we're going to have a vaccine imminently. So who of these two men is best placed to restore the American economy? And that's a conversation in which Donald Trump, according to polls, does much better against Joe Biden.
And with Kamala Harris on the ticket, this exchange from your interview becomes even more salient. Trump claims he's been a better president for African Americans than any president except Lincoln. Even LBJ, who got the major civil rights laws passed in the 1960s, and you pressed him on that, as we hear in this clip. And I think we have that clip. Where
you believe you did more than Lyndon Johnson, who passed the Civil Rights Act?
I think I did, yeah.
How?
Because I
How
got criminal justice reform done. I got prison reform.
Lyndon Johnson.
I've done things.
He passed the Civil Rights Act.
How has it worked out? If you take a look at what Lyndon Johnson did.
You think the Civil Rights Act was a mistake?
How has it worked out? Because frankly, it took a long time. But for African Americans, under my administration, Jonathan, under my administration, African Americans were doing better than they had ever done in the history of this country. So I did a lot. Job numbers, all of the money. They had money. They were getting great. Their percentage was up. Their housing ownership was up. They did better than they've ever done.
I just don't know how you can.
So, Jonathan, what was the president even trying to say there, asking you how that Civil Rights Act worked out?
Well, I was, as you can, I think, tell from the clip, I was stunned when he said that and tried to clarify in the moment, what do you mean, how has that worked out? Are you suggesting that it was a mistake to pass that piece of legislation? It was one of those moments, and then he sort of, you know, pivoted what he has these pre-programmed riffs that he delivers on the black unemployment rate under his presidency, which was the lowest, I think in at least recent memory. But it's his default response to basically any question that concerns race. Later in the interview, I was asking him about, you know, why he thinks whether he thinks that police treat African-Americans differently from white Americans. And again, he doesn't like engaging with those questions. He simply likes to tout those statistics as the answer to everything. He has said publicly numerous times that he believes that the way to achieve harmony in this country is through economic policy. He doesn't tend to engage on any other level with these issues.
Jonathan, I know you have to go. Thank you for giving us some time today. Jonathan Swan, WNYC legal editor and All Things Considered host, Jamie Floyd. Jamie, thank you so much. Such a deep analysis. And I didn't even realize that you personally knew, even if through a degree of separation, Kamala Harris, or how close your connection was, as both of you worked in San Francisco at the same time. So thank you for such a deep analysis.
Thank you. See you soon, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.